The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Welcome to the Pat Williams Power Hour on 94.9 FM and AM 950, The Word. This is your hour when Orlando Magic Senior Vice President Pat Williams sits down and speaks with authors who have written books on topics of interest and insight for listeners like you. And now, here's your host, Pat Williams.
Welcome again, folks, to the Pat Williams Saturday Power Hour. It's 94.9 FM and AM 950, The Word in Orlando, and we're always so happy when you join us. So is Alan Dempsey. He's our engineer, the man behind the glass, and Andrew Herdliska produces this show for us each weekend. Sean Smucker joins us from Lancaster, Pennsylvania. His book is out with Revell, Once We Were Strangers, What Friendship with a Syrian Refugee Taught Me About Loving My Neighbor. Sean, welcome. Nice to talk to you. How are you?
I'm good. Thanks, Pat. Thanks for having me.
Give me the background on this book.
Yeah, so I was doing some volunteer work with an organization called Church World Service, CWS, and they're a refugee resettlement organization here in the States. They help refugees get settled after they're here. And I was doing some spotlights on some of the people they were helping and just writing some things up for my blog and for their site. And it was at that point in about, 2015, 2016, when things in Syria were getting really bad. And so I asked them if they could connect me with any Syrians here in Lancaster. I was just interested in meeting someone and kind of getting to know them better. And so they connected me with Muhammad, and that's kind of where it all began.
Who is Muhammad?
Muhammad is, he's a Syrian refugee. He's married. He has four sons, and he arrived here in the States in 2016 after spending 4 years in Jordan. He had fled Syria to the south through, he and his wife and kids hiked through about 20 miles of wilderness. Ended up in one of the largest refugee camps in the world, the Zaatari. There are about 80,000 people there. I think it's like the fourth largest city now in Jordan. So he was there for a little while, stayed in the country of Jordan for 4 years, and then the UN helped to relocate him here to the States.
I want you to explain how you put this book together. Part one is the friend, part two, the foreigner, part three is the neighbor. Part one, the friend, and you do 11 different chapters there. What's the background here? What's the story on this first part?
Yeah, so the first part was really based out of my first meeting with Muhammad. I went into the CWS office to meet him, and I had a translator with me. And so I was a little nervous. I didn't really know, you know, what he would think of me. I know what a lot of Americans think of Middle Easterners, and you kind of see on the news the violence and everything that happens over there in regards to the West. So I wasn't sure what he would think of me. Well, we sat down and started talking through our translator. At some point, I told him, you know, I mean, he knew that we were meeting to explore the idea of writing a book. And so at some point, I just wanted to make sure he understood that, you know, it was very early in the process and that it was pretty possible that a book would not come of this. So I told him, I said, you know, Muhammad, thank you for meeting with me, but it's quite possible nothing will come of this. And he said something that really struck me through the translator, who turned to me and said, it's impossible for nothing to come of this because we're friends now. And that had a really big impact on me, that he would be so open and so welcoming to me, even though he was the person who was, you know, out of his element in a strange place, talking to strange people. And so at that moment, I really felt, I just felt like my heart really opened up to him, and we became friends from there and just started spending more time together.
Do you continue to see him?
He has actually moved in the spring. He moved out to Michigan, to Grand Rapids, or just east of Grand Rapids. He had some friends out there. And so we still talk on the phone about once a week, and I get out there every once in a while, and whenever I go, I see him. I saw him a couple of weeks ago, and it was really good to catch up. But, we became quite good friends, so it's really sad to me that he's not around here anymore.
Has he learned English?
Yeah, he has. Yeah, he was speaking. We actually didn't use a translator for the rest of our meetings. It was just that first one because I wasn't sure exactly where he was at, but he speaks very good English. His wife is learning English. His boys are actually wonderful English speakers. There were times when Muhammad would be trying to tell me a story and we get stuck on a word, and so we'd have to shout for his boys to come over and interpret for us. But they're all doing really well.
The second part of your book is called The Foreigner. What are you writing there? What's that about?
That section focuses a little bit more on his journey. So his decision to leave Syria after his village was consistently getting bombed by the government, his time in Jordan, which was, you know, just, it was very frustrating. It was a time that he wasn't allowed to work. The kids couldn't go to school. So it was just sort of very long days, day after day after day. And what it was like for him then to arrive in the States and to make friends and to get a job and to become self-sufficient. So it was, you know, kind of that journey for him as a foreigner. But it was also for me thinking a little bit more about the Old Testament and how, you know, so many times the Israelites are, they're asked to remember that they were once foreigners. And, you know, to treat the foreigners among them with respect and dignity and love, and because they were once foreigners. And so that was sort of the other part that was going on there, was me just reflecting back on those sorts of commands or instances or encouragements in the Bible and reflecting on how I was treating the foreigners in my midst.
How did he get into the States? He was pretty fortunate, wasn't he?
Yeah, he was very fortunate. There was basically kind of a lottery going on. He would go to the UN office every day or every week and speak with whoever he could. And there was for some time there, it looked like he may go to Scandinavia or Germany. Refugees don't really have much of a say in where they go. They're sort of overseen by the UN, and then the other countries who are involved work with the refugee resettlement group to decide, you know, who's going to get who and who's going to go where. So it was really at the last minute. I think there were, you know, at the point that he was in Jordan, I think there were 500,000, 600,000 refugees there. And I think they were only taking maybe 5 or 10,000 to the state. So, yeah, he was very fortunate.
How does he feel about his native land?
Most of the time when we talk, I mean, he misses it. He misses his mom. He misses his siblings who are still there. But there's really nothing left of his village. Very few people live there anymore. So he's sad about having to leave. But he's so patriotic about the U.S. I'm always amazed at how enthusiastic he is. And it makes sense. You know, this country's given him a new start and a new chance, and especially hope for his boys and for his family. So, he loves Syria, but there's just nothing really left there for him.
How old are his boys, and what will become of them?
So his sons are around, freshman in high school, so I think 15, and then 8th grade, 6th grade, and 2nd grade. So, they're doing really well. They're adjusting well. They're doing well in school. They have high hopes. They love the fact that they can get an education. You know, they were getting that in Syria, but then in Jordan that wasn't happening. So they're really excited about going to school and learning, and they all seem to be adapting really well.
Sean Smucker is our guest. He's in Lancaster, Pennsylvania. His book is out. It's called Once We Were Strangers, What Friendship with a Syrian Refugee Taught Me About Loving My Neighbor. And we've got another segment with Sean A very, very interesting story. Muhammad, who made his way through the wilderness to Jordan, fleeing from the chemical warfare and violence in Syria. He left behind his home village and the only world he ever knew, hoping to find a better life for his family in a new world where foreigners are looked upon with eyes that reveal contempt and fear. And of course, our guest, Sean, a middle-aged man living in America's oldest inland city, made a modest and happy life for his family as a writer. Somehow, he found himself staring at the face of the stranger sitting across from him. And that's our story. That's what we're talking about. We've got another segment with Sean. But first, we've got messages right here on the Pat Williams Saturday Power Hour. It's 94.9 FM and AM 950, The Word in Orlando.
More of the Pat Williams Power Hour in just a moment on 94.9 FM and AM 950, The Word. You're listening to the Pat Williams Power Hour on 94.9 FM and AM 950, The Word. Now, once again, here's Pat.
As we have mentioned, this book of Sean's is in three parts, The Friend, The Foreigner, and then part three is The Neighbor. That's where we've arrived, Sean. What are you writing about there in the third part?
The third part, The Neighbor, is really a reflection on the story that Jesus tells of the Good Samaritan. And so, you know, an expert in religious law comes to him and is trying to figure out how to get eternal life. And eventually he and Jesus sort of hammer down to this point where Jesus says, love your neighbor as yourself. And the man turns around and asks, well, who is my neighbor? And instead of answering that question, Jesus tells the story of the Good Samaritan, a story that many of us know. I know I grew up hearing that story all the time. And it's that story really that came to my mind so often in my friendship with Muhammad is, you know, Muhammad is my neighbor. What will I do? Will I just leave him to fend for himself, or will I use all of my resources and my relationships and my friendship to just to try and help him have a better life? And so that's what I start to unpack a little bit in that last section.
You're a novelist. So how did a novelist write this memoir? Was it helpful to you?
Yeah, I mean, so being a novelist definitely, I think, helps with finding a story arc and, you know, trying to create the things that go into creating a good novel. But I also make a living co-writing and ghostwriting books, and most of those are memoirs for other people. So I've written a lot of nonfiction books, a lot of memoirs, and this didn't feel too much of a stretch for me.
Sean, how do you describe Lancaster County, Pennsylvania, to one who's never been there?
Yeah, so Lancaster, well known for the Amish who live out in the country. And then we have a small city sort of at the center of the county. And it's about 70,000 people, 70,000 people. It's a really beautiful little city. And it's one of the most welcoming. I read recently somewhere that there are more refugees per capita in Lancaster County than any other place in the United States. So it's a very welcoming place. There's a lot of diversity, especially here in the city. And it's, I don't know, I think it's a really nice place for someone to end up. There are so many people here who want to try and help, and Muhammad really seemed to enjoy his time here.
Sean, so many novels are now being written about the Amish. Why is that? What are your thoughts?
That's interesting. I think we have, you know, as we speed forward in technology and as we speed forward in sort of not knowing our neighbors anymore and being so busy and really relatively isolated relationally, I think there's a real interest and a real fascination with this community, you know, that remains a strong community even in the midst of all these other cultural changes that are happening. So I think people are fascinated with that. I think people are always fascinated with simpler times. And I really believe that's kind of what lies at the heart of that.
Do we know what the Amish believe? Where do they stand spiritually?
They are, they're Anabaptist, so they would be very closely aligned with Mennonites. Let's see, pacifists, so they wouldn't fight in war. The main difference between the Amish and the Mennonite is that the Amish believe in a very strict separation from the rest of society, and also the practice of shunning. So if you don't follow their rules to the T, you will be shunned from the community. That's sort of unique to the Amish community. They are very works-oriented as far as, you know, their faith goes. So salvation is something that's earned through living a good life and living, you know, according to particular rules that your community creates. So it's, that has a lot to do with the way that they live.
Do they have church services?
Yeah, they meet in homes, usually every other week, and it rotates throughout their the area. So you have a bishop who oversees an area, and each area also has a couple of, they're called districts. Each district also has a couple of preachers and a deacon. And so the church sort of rotates at different houses throughout the district.
If you and I wanted to pop in and go to one of their services, would we be allowed?
Yeah, I think we could. I think, and especially because I still have Amish relatives. So if you ever want to go, just let me know.
How about that? Very, very interesting. What are your thoughts, Sean, as you're reading about these refugees coming up from Central America and hoofing their way through Mexico, heading to the U.S. border? What do you think?
It's a sad situation. I mean, my thoughts are that we should continue to treat that situation the way that we have for decades now, which is basically, you know, it's legal for someone to show up at our border and ask for asylum, and then their case needs to be considered. That's kind of where I'm at with it right now, but obviously we have to continue to watch and see how it plays out.
My guest is Sean Smucker. He has written this very, very interesting book called Once We Were Strangers. So to listeners today, Sean, based on what you've written here in your story, what do you tell us? What's your advice?
I would say, you know, I mean, this book is on the face of it, a book about welcoming refugees, but I think there's also a deeper level to it about how important it is for us to return to getting to know our neighbors, you know? And so whether or not your neighbors are refugees or immigrants or have lived in America their whole lives, I just think it's so important that we return to that practice of knowing the people who are around us. You know, I think so many of us just drive our cars into our garages and we never speak to anyone outside of our house, rarely know anyone. I mean, we're on Facebook and Twitter, and so we feel like we're interacting with people, but I think we're actually really lonely for the most part. And I'm not sure that many of us know how to be a good friend anymore. I certainly realized that about myself. As I became friends with Muhammad, I realized how isolated I am and how selfish I am. And so I would just encourage people, you know, and I think the book encourages people to open up your hearts to your neighbors and get to know people. And I think that would do a lot to help to stem this sort of tide of fear that we've been experiencing.
Sean, is immigration aid and refugee assistance a cultural, political, or faith issue?
Well, you know, I don't think that refugee resettlement was a political issue for a long time, because it was basically something that was started by, I believe it was Ronald Reagan in the early 80s, and it was something that was carried on by both parties. Recently, it's become highly politicized, which I think is unfortunate, because basically, with a refugee, you just have someone who, you know, who's fleeing their country because they have no other options. And so It's a really, really difficult situation, and it's sad. But I think if we are Christians, if we're practicing Christians, I think it's really important that we analyze the words of Christ in trying to decide how we're going to respond to these things.
What do you think God's position is on this issue, which creates so much debate at work, church, and families around the country? What do you think he thinks?
Well, I think Jesus said what his position was, you know, love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength, and love your neighbor as yourself. And so, you know, how would I want to be loved if I was Mahan Tree? How would I want to be helped and welcomed in? I think we just have to continually ask ourselves, using the golden rule, how would we want to be treated if we were in that situation?
Author Sean Smucker is in Lancaster, PA, the author of Once We Were Strangers. Sean, I want you to react to this statement. Many of the more than 3 million refugees provided for and protected by the U.S. since 1975 have contributed to America's rich history through their influence, expertise, and military service. What's your reaction to that statement?
Yeah, I think it's something that we should all dwell on, you know, and think about. It's important to know the facts when it comes to refugees, and you know, an important fact is that no refugee has ever been involved in a terrorist act in the United States, and there are other, you know, there are facts like that that I think we need to be aware of when we're trying to make decisions about who we're going to welcome in and the policies that we're going to make, and so. Yeah, I think in my experience with Muhammad and many other refugees here in Lancaster, they are some of the most hardworking people I've met. They're determined to pay their way. They have to repay the expenses that were incurred bringing them here. So, you know, even though they are flown here and resettled, those are costs that they have to pay back. So the refugee resettlement program is a really wonderful thing, and I think that the people that it brings to the U.S. benefit our society, our culture.
I'm interested in a man like Muhammad. What is his skill set? So many refugees come, and I guess the real question is, do they all have a skill?
Sure, yeah. He was basically a truck driver and owned a small market in Syria, so he definitely has some business and entrepreneurial acumen. He's interested in that sort of thing. He's currently training to get his CDL to become a truck driver, which is in huge demand right now. There are companies, you know, are desperate to hire more truck drivers. So I think that's the thing with the refugees that are coming in, is that they're willing to do the jobs that a lot of us don't want to do. And so, you know, he worked at a dry cleaner for months when he first got here, I think for over a year, actually. And so they're willing to work really hard, and they were working two or three jobs at a time just so that they could be self-sufficient and pay their own bills.
It'll be interesting with his children, whether they get a chance to go on and get a college education. That to me will be the fascinating part.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think that's definitely it, and that's certainly the goal. I think Muhammad sort of sees his life as a stepping stone for his kids. He's not he doesn't have any sort of aspirations of being extremely wealthy or you know, going back to college himself. But he is here for his boys. He came here for his boys, and he's living here for his boys, and he's going to do everything that he can to make sure that they end up with really good jobs and a good education. So, yeah, I think you're right. It will be very interesting to see how that goes.
What do we know about the boy's mother?
Maradi, she was working alongside Muhammad at the dry cleaner, and then she got a job at a hotel. And she's currently taking English lessons out in Michigan where they moved.
I wonder if they are the average refugee. Do you think they have a desire to go back home at some point, or is that long gone?
I've heard of some who have gone back, even back to Syria now. In fact, some friends of Muhammad's who he didn't know in Syria, but he met them here in Lancaster. They were Syrian refugees, and they went back for a time, just trying to see if it was still, if it would be safe for them to live there. And I'm not sure if they're still there or not. So, I mean, there's, you know, there's such a strong desire to be home that I tend to discount. I think I tend to feel like, oh, we're there, they're in the States now, you know, like, why would you ever want to leave the U.S.? But they still have so much, so many memories and so much sort of back there. I think it really depends on the state of the place that they left. And so, like I said, in Muhammad's case, there's just really nothing left.
What do you want people to take from our chat here, Sean?
I would love it if people would meet a refugee, you know, like just go out of your way to get to know somebody. It will certainly open your eyes. I don't know that it will definitely change anyone's views from positive to negative or negative to positive, but I think that, you know, there's just so much good in getting outside of the messages that we're seeing and hearing on the television and actually meeting someone face-to-face. So,
well, I'm so glad we could visit Sean Smucker, author of Once We Were Strangers, our guest. We've got more after this on the Pat Williams Saturday Power Hour. It's 94.9 FM and AM 950, The Word in Orlando.
More of the Pat Williams Power Hour in just a moment on 94.9 FM and AM 950, The Word. You're listening to the Pat Williams Power Hour on 94.9 FM and AM 950, The Word. Now, once again, here's Pat.
Jerry Jenkins joins me. Longtime friend, many years. He's in Colorado Springs. You know Jerry, co-author of the Left Behind series, and he's got another one coming, the new series, the Dead Sea Chronicles. Jerry, good to catch up with you. How are you?
I'm doing great, Pat. Good to talk to you.
So the Dead Sea Chronicles, give me a little background. How did this all come about?
Well, it really was the idea of the publisher, Bluthy Publishing, out of Tennessee. I've done some work with them before, and usually I don't need ideas. I've got more ideas than I think I have years left to write, but they just bounced off maybe this idea of, you know, how about a story about an archaeologist who discovers something in the Middle East that might change the face of history there.
And,
so I listened to the idea and really liked it. Byron Williamson is the head of Worthy, and it was kind of his idea. They're associated with the Museum of the Bible in Washington, and so this is all sort of a part of that project. And I just kind of took that idea and ran with it. I have a main character who's a late 30s female archaeologist, and she's the one who wants to do this dig in the Holy Land, and she's found something she wants to follow up on. So there's a modern-day story, and then every other chapter, I switch back 4,000 years to the birth of Abraham. So you've really got a biblical novel and a contemporary story all in one, and I really had fun with it. I think it was informed by the sort of binge-watching of television that we all do now with Netflix and some of these other servers where writers have learned to do setups and payoffs. Some are series long, some are episode long, some are every 10 minutes you have a setup and a payoff. And so I think readers nowadays, addicted to screens, you know, are impatient. And so they want quick little vignettes and scenes and stories that keep moving. So that's what I tried to do here.
Tell me more about Nicole Berman.
Yeah, she's the main character, and as I say, she's an archaeologist. And one thing I've learned in researching this, and I have a biblical and archaeological consultant, Dr. Craig Evans, out of Houston Baptist University. An archaeologist has to have two doctorates, one in their field of study, and then another that's specifically designed for international archaeology. And if they don't have both these dead, they'll never be the head of a dig anywhere and that type of thing. Well, this woman is the daughter of a man who owns the foundation that finances this dig, and he's an archaeologist too. But I tell his story as well, and of course this is all fiction, it's all made up, but he's a Vietnam vet, so I have some scenes set in Vietnam and how he kind of strayed from his wealthy East Coast family and wanted to be his own person, and then was wounded in Vietnam. It turns out he's Jewish by ethnicity, but the woman he meets when he comes back home wounded as an evangelical Christian and leads him to faith. And so he becomes what we refer to as a messianic Jew, a Jew who believes that Jesus is the Messiah. So that's the way this girl was raised. And she's independent, she's feisty, she's smart, and she's single. At the time we open the series, this I hope will be about a six-book series. It all depends on how the market responds. If they like it, they get more. If they don't, then I'm on something else. But that's Nicole Berman.
Jerry, where do your ideas come from? Are novelists born, or are they developed?
You know, I think it's a little of both. The writing and the skill set, that type of thing, can be honed and polished. And I consider myself a lifelong learner. I always want to be growing, and I want each book to be better than the last. But there is an element to some of us novelists anyway, that it's this idea machine and where they come from. Mine often come from disparate ideas that kind of kick around in my head. I'll hear about one idea and think that's interesting, and it doesn't go anywhere until I hear another one that sort of juxtaposes with it. Now, with this, since the basic idea came from the publisher and they thought it fit my skill set, what happened here was that the idea of an archaeologist who discovers something monumental in the Middle East is interesting. But to me, telling both those stories at the same time, going back 4,000 years to the birth of Abraham, who eventually spawns Isaac and Ishmael, who are at enmity to this day, if you watch the news, that's what makes it interesting to me. And then being able to tell this father's Vietnam story, too, and how he comes to faith and what, you know, how that shapes the girl. It's that type of thing, but you know, when you say, where do ideas come from, I think it's just letting those things rattle around, think about them as they grow. If I tell this story to my wife or to my grown sons, and every time I tell it, it gets embellished and more, then I know it has legs. If I forget about it, or if it just lies there, then I let it go, because readers would let it go too. So that's where the ideas came for this one.
How much did you know about Abraham in detail, Jerry, before you plunged into this work?
Not enough, I discovered. You know, you grow up in the church and you hear all the stories, but that's a fairly, superficial bit of training. And so when I was doing the writing on this first book, I have a chart in my office that I hang from a flip chart, and it's probably 4 feet by 5 feet, and it shows all the lineages from the beginning of time, at least from the biblical record. And I was astounded to realize how many of the patriarchs were still alive when other ones were born. For instance, when Abraham was born, Noah's sons were still alive. And so Abraham, at a young age, I speculate, visited his ancestors and heard firsthand accounts of what happened on the ark, the whole flood thing, and back in those times when men walked and talked with God. So I really felt like I went to seminary here for the last year. And then having this Dr. Evans, who's a brilliant biblical scholar, just down the other end of the phone or a mouse click away, is such a privilege, because he's a fount of information. He keeps me on track theologically and then professionally with the archaeology. I'll be writing a scene, and I'll just think, now, what would they use here, and what would be their purpose, and does this make sense? And I just, hit him with a question, and within an hour, I'll get a page or two of really fascinating stuff. So it's been great. Mm.
So when you finish one of these, Jerry, how do you know what to do with the second one, or is it already prearranged in your mind?
Well, I'm always a little bit surprised. I tend to be what we refer to in the business as a pantser. There are outliners and pantsers. Pantsers right by the seat of their pants. Stephen King says, put interesting characters in difficult situations and write to find out what happens. That really describes my process. So I have an idea where I'm going, and I had an idea where the whole series should go, but I'm never sure how long it'll take to get to some major points. And I like to end a book on a real high note. I want it to be complete in itself, so it's a satisfying read, but I want the reader to then really be eager for the next book. And so with this one, I've done a lot of those, as I mentioned, short setups for quick payoffs. I've done chapter-length setups and payoffs. But I've got a series setup and payoff, too. So the big setup at the end of book one, there's an implied promise that it'll be paid off in the next book or two. So I'm eager to get to the writing of book two myself, because I want to know if it turns out the way I think it's going to, or if I'm going to be pleasantly surprised or disappointed. I think it's good for the author to not know everything, because then the book can't be predictable to the reader, because if the writer doesn't know, the reader sure can't know what's coming.
Jerry Jenkins, New York Times best-selling author, is our guest. He's got a new book coming. It's going to be released in November 2018 with Worthy Publishing. The new series is called The Dead Sea Chronicles. The first book is called Dead Sea Rising. And Jerry, that raises a fascinating point. When you sit down to write, do you have prearranged ideas, or do they come to you as you're writing?
It's a little of both. Because I'm a pantser, as I mentioned, I have an idea where I'm going. I have some major plot points that I want to hit. But I also want to be surprised. I want the characters to take me where they will. They often say things that surprise me and take me on different paths. And I think that's what makes us authors, is deciding, is this just a silly rabbit trail that I need to ignore, or is this an interesting way to go? I tend to be sort of an intuitive plotter. Some people plot these things out, and they say at the 10% mark, I need this inciting incident, at the 25% mark, I need this twist or whatever. Those sort of come to me as I go. And I'm usually happy with the result, and if I'm not, I just make adjustments. But that's the fun of it, is that having an idea where you're going and getting there is satisfying, but seeing where the characters in the story takes you, that's the fun of it.
Jerry, why is Christian fiction so popular?
You know, I think people are looking for something beyond themselves. You know, my experience with the Left Behind phenomenon really taught me that people read books by the Pope and the Dalai Lama and the Eastern mystics, and they hear about fiction that's based on biblical prophecy, and they just think, well, this satisfies a thirst and a hunger. I want to know what's coming. We live in fearful times, and it seems to be getting worse all the time, so people want to have some idea of what might be coming. And This series may not be as prophetic as the Left Behind series, but it is still based on prophecy, because even the very title, Dead Sea Rising, people who have heard of the Dead Sea or have visited it realize this is truly a dead sea. It's just so full of salt that you can float without crying, and it's hard for anything to live there. But the scripture says that the day will come when that becomes a hotbed again of live fish and wildlife and all that. And so what does that mean? Why is that going to happen? What comes with it? That's a really stark reality, that the Dead Sea will rise again. So that's why I think people are attracted to books like this.
Jerry, how do you explain the phenomenon of the Left Behind series?
Well, I'd love to think it was the great writing.
Aside from the great writing, of course.
Yeah. Well, again, people are looking for something beyond themselves. They hear about fiction based on biblical prophecy. And all we were saying was, we're going to stick close to what the scripture says as far as the predictions. but we're going to speculate on what that might look like. Let's assume this happens next year or 10 years from now. Put characters in the way of these events and say, how would you react? How would you feel? And I think one of the secrets, which I didn't realize when I did it at the time, I have the rapture, the disappearance of true believers from the earth in an instant, happened in the first chapter of the first book. So the only people who are left are the uninitiated or the unbelievers. And some of them realize immediately, this is what my friends were trying to tell me all this time. Clearly, this is this fulfillment of Scripture. Other people are saying, how can you say God is behind this when all this chaos is left? But the characters are searching for the truth. And all the people who would have inside lingo, the evangelical terminology, the church talk, they're gone. So the ones that are left are normal people saying, if this happened, what would I think? Where would I go to find answers, and what would I make of this? And so I included credible, skeptical characters, because there are people who simply, even though it's an obvious fulfillment of prophecy, still harden their hearts, still don't believe. And so not everybody comes to faith. If this had been one of those books where the rapture happens, everybody sees that's the truth, so they come to faith too, and all live happily ever after. That's not how life is. There are those of us who are people of faith. We share our faith all the time. And some people respond to it, and a lot of people don't. And so I found letters from people who would say, I saw myself in this book. This is how I would have reacted. And other people would say, this is a bunch of baloney. I don't believe it, and this character and that character don't believe it either, and it resonates with me. So I think trying to be realistic and yet show what it could look like if real people were in the way of these biblical events, that's what made it work. And then the turning of the millennium right in the middle of our series. Some people accused us of doing it that way on purpose, you know, the timing. We had no idea that people would see the end of the millennium as having anything to do with the end of the world, because our calendar is 4 years off as it is, so who knows when anything ends or what it means.
Terry Jenkins, with us from Colorado, author of the new book, Dead Sea Rising. We got another segment with Jerry. Stay with us right here on the Pat Williams Saturday Power Hour. It's 94.9 FM and AM 950 The Word in Orlando.
More of the Pat Williams Power Hour in just a moment on 94.9 FM and AM 950, The Word. You're listening to the Pat Williams Power Hour on 94.9 FM and AM 950, The Word. Now, once again, here's Pat.
Jenkins is with us, talking about his new book, Dead Sea Rising. Jerry, I must ask you your most vivid memories of the late Tim LaHaye.
Well, Tim was a fascinating guy, and he was well known for being kind of a polemic. He was he had strong opinions, and he was a fighter. He would take on issues, but I remember him as kind of a softy. He wasn't a large man, he was a little guy, a brilliant scholar and quite a thinker. But when we would go to signings, you'd look up after a while and realize Tim was gone.
Really?
You'd have to look over somewhere and you'd find him in a corner praying with somebody. Somebody would come up to the signing table and mention a prayer request or tell him they were seeking or had questions about the faith. And he would just, that would become his priority. I mean, he was a soul winner. That's the term we use in the evangelical community for somebody that he just wants people to come to faith, and he cared about people. I saw this happen in green rooms and network television shows, too. Somebody would come in and introduce themselves to us and say they'd be interviewing us, and before you know it, there's Tim in the corner with that person praying. But he was a great husband. He was, he and Bev, I think, were married 65 years, or in fact, it would have been more than that because he died at 90, and I think they were married before he was 25. So 60-plus years married, had four kids, and was just consistent. For a long time, he would preach, he would write, he would teach, speak, and there's never a hint of a scandal with him. He was the real deal.
Jerry, tell me about the Jerry Jenkins Writers Guild, and what's the purpose of that organization?
You know, I feel so blessed in my career, having written so many books and sold so many books, and I just feel obligated and privileged to be able to pass it forward. So I have the Jerry Jenkins Writers Guild online, and it's basically just me with a team that works out of, and I live in Colorado, but a team that works out of Tennessee. And these are all, I call them the six-year-old. These are all the young guys that know the technology and all the metrics of marketing and that type of thing. And so I'm just teaching students online. And the thing has caught on. I thought maybe I'd have 300 or 400 students that would pay a little bit each month to get some tips. And we have over 2,000 now.
Mm.
So it keeps me busy between books and during books. I'm keeping up with them and providing fresh content for them every month. And it's just been a thrill. I really love doing it.
Jerry, I am of the belief that everybody feels that they have a book in them. Do you find that?
Yeah, I'm sure you have the same experience I do with all the books that you've had under your belt. And it's hard to believe, but you and I met 45 years ago when I did a little story about you and then wound up. I think you're helping you with your autobiography is my fourth book and back in the 70s. But, yeah, people who find out you write books, they come up and they say, I've got a book in me. And frankly, that's the market for my Writers Guild. It used to be I'd say, well, you know, very few people really do have a book in them. But I didn't want to discourage people because I had that dream once too, so did you. And for some of us, it works out if you can learn and get the basics down. And so I thought, why not? If people believe they have a book in them, let's teach you how to do it right. It's not a hobby. It's not a diversion. It's a real important discipline of study. And so so I offer that, and there seems to be no end to that market, as you say. Everybody feels like they've got a book in them somewhere, and I'm happy to help them find out if that's true.
So they come, Jerry, and they say to me, I want to write a book. What should I do? And I say, write the book.
Yeah.
No, what should I do? No, write the book. Well, how do I do that? One page at a time, sir. At the end of 1 year, you'll have 365 pages, which is far too much, but write the book. Well, then what do I do? And I say, well, that's the easy part, finding a publisher. They're all over the place. But write it first. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. And you know, people think there's some secret to it or some magic formula or some potion that's going to make them bestseller overnight. Fact is, it's hard work, and if you want to write a book, you have to write it, and you'll figure it out. I mean, as you say, you know, you can talk to people. You know, dreamers talk about writing. Writers write.
Mm.
So get your seat in the chair. Study everything. I mean, there's magazines about writing. There's books about writing. There's seminars. There's webinars. All kinds of things all over the place. So learn what you need to learn, get the thing down, and then I urge people to look for a traditional publisher. That's a publisher that pays you.
Yes.
A lot of people resort to self-publishing where you pay to be printed rather than getting paid to be published. But that I say use that as a last resort, but that's a valid option too. If somebody feels they really want to get their book out and a traditional publisher doesn't want it, they can always resort to self-publishing if they can afford it, and there are cheap ways to do it too. You can release a book online for virtually nothing, and people are doing it all the time. And so, yeah, there are all kinds of possibilities like there's never been before.
Jerry, what is the state of Christian publishing as we speak?
I think we're going through a real metamorphosis. It's hard for Christian bookstores to survive. In fact, the whole association of Christian bookstores, the Christian Booksellers Association, seems to be disbanding at this point, and other groups are sort of taking over, and you know, the publishing groups that are saying let's redo this. But there's always going to be a place for inspirational writing, and people want it, need it. It may have a different face than it's had before. A lot of the big box stores, the big discounters, they take Christian books as well and sell them cheaply enough that that's where people buy them. And we can fight against that and say hurting the little guy and all that stuff. But the fact is, we live in a free enterprise system, and the more competition there is like that, the better it is for the consumer. And what I tell writers is, regardless of what happens in the marketplace and in the business, the writing still has to be good. Mm. It still has to be compelling, and it still has to make people keep turning pages. So learn how to do it right, give it your best shot, and then we don't determine the market. And people often said, how do I write a bestseller? You don't write a bestseller. You write from passion of your heart, and if it's good enough, word of mouth will make it a bestseller.
I once had a publisher say to me, Jerry, you can't sell books one at a time. You've got to get the army working for you. What does that mean?
I think that's all about word of mouth. You know, I've seen publishers put literally millions into promoting books that people just don't care that much about. And if you don't get that word of mouth, you're going to sell a few because of the marketing effort. But it's when you hit that tipping point that Malcolm Gladwell talks about, when enough people are reading it and saying, you have to read this, that's what makes people buy books. When I get a friend I trust say, you have got to read this book, that's the book I buy. And that just tends to grow exponentially. The more people read them and like them and talk about them, the more people buy them. And that gives me sort of great comfort as a writer. You'd love to engineer that part yourself and say, I'm going to write this and I'm going to sell the hound out of it. Fact is, that's not my wheelhouse. My wheelhouse is content. I need to be writing and working on getting people turning the pages. And then what happens in the marketplace, I don't have control over, so I don't worry about it. I felt called to full-time Christian work, and writing is just the way I fulfill that call. So just by writing, I'm obeying and succeeding. What happens after that is really not in my hands. So I can get on to the next book.
In other words, God gave you a talent in writing. He gave you a passion to do it. And right there at that intersection, Jerry, let's call that the sweet spot. That's where you have been spending your life.
That's exactly. And it might sound falsely modest, but I believe I've been mono-gifted. I don't sing or dance or preach. Mm-hmm. I just write. And that's why I feel obligated to keep doing it. I mean, this Dead Sea Rising is my 195th book. I mean, I've written more books than I've ever read, you know. But that's where my sweet spot is, and that's why I feel obligated to keep doing it.
Jerry Jenkins has been our guest. We've got to wrap up right after this on the Pat Williams Saturday Power Hour. This is 94.9 FM and AM 950, The Word in Orlando.
More of the Pat Williams Power Hour in just a moment on 94.9 FM and AM 950, The Word. You're listening to the Pat Williams Power Hour on 94.9 FM and AM 950, The Word. Now, once again, here's Pat.
Thanks so much for joining us, folks. Here on the Pat Williams Saturday Power Hour, Sean Smucker was our guest in the first half hour, talking about his book, Once We Were Strangers. And in the second segment, author Jerry Jenkins, best-selling author Jerry Jenkins, was with us, talking about his new book, which is part of a six-book series, Dead Sea Rising. Please visit my website. It's patwilliams.com. The Twitter page, Orlando Magic Pat. And my most recent book is out. It's called Coach Wooden's Forgotten Teams. We take a look at the great Coach John Wooden and his summer camps. So much to learn from the great John Wooden. Have a wonderful week ahead, folks. We'll be back next weekend for more on the Pat Williams Saturday Power Hour. It's 94.9 FM. And AM 950, The Word. And remember, faith comes by hearing.
Thank you for joining us for this week's edition of the Pat Williams Power Hour. Join us again next week at the same time, where faith comes by hearing. 94.9 FM and AM 950. The Word.
Three-star general Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.